Randall James, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Les. Always a pleasure to be here, man. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Yeah.
This is
thanks for having me, man. I love coming on. I think we have some really good chats. Our New Year's episode that we did ages ago, exactly a year ago, actually, did really well. So, yeah, I think we agree on a lot of things. We disagree on a lot of things, but it always ends up being a good conversation.
Yeah, we have a history of agreeing and disagreeing and to various degrees of intensity of debate.
Right.
And I think exactly. It's helped us both grow. And for the listeners, just a reminder, Randall has been on the podcast before. He's the host of the Always Adaptive podcast, which and YouTube channel, which definitely recommend you checking out. Does a lot of health and fitness-based content and also offers individual training in person and also virtually, right?
Yeah, online and strength and running. So I know the hybrid thing is all the rage these days. So I've sort of been tapping into that a little bit. I really, as you know, I really value running. Not that I think everyone has to run, but that's just something I personally like as a cardio modality. So I offer people race prep if they just want to run for general health, whatever it is. It's basically just building like a holistic program of lifting and cardiovascular training as well.
Well, I love running. I do it almost 2 whole minutes a week, but I break that up into little pieces.
So what is that like, 15 second hard sprints?
Yeah, usually 10 to 20 seconds at a time. Like start off really easy and just as my old joints get warmed up, you know, I might give it a little hard effort at the back end of the last couple reps. So that's, you know, it's pretty minimal. I really just try to focus on technique and not doing too much.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And honestly, I don't really do, like, I really like 200 meter intervals, but I won't go further than that unless I'm training for a race. Like if I'm training for a race, then I'll start to do 400s, 800s, 1Ks, all that stuff. But I think 200s are just short enough that when it starts to suck, it's over. And you're like, okay, now I can rest, you know. But I agree. I love hill sprints. Those are like, every time I write a training program for someone for running, it always starts intervals with hill sprints, short bursts, 10, 15 seconds or so.
Gotcha. Nice. So there was something I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, and I guess I wanted to share with the viewers. I've been getting different types of feedback recently from some of the videos, and I think partly is because I am just becoming a more honorary podcast host, and it might for some people sound like I'm changing, but I'm not. I'm actually just allowing myself to be a little bit more myself. I feel like I've been doing this for 5 years now. I think I'm coming up on 200 interviews. And nice. I've always just tried to be really nice and really kind, which I do want to be. But also, I find like I do have a lot of opinions. I just hold them in. And I have a history of really getting frustrated when a conversation is moving in a direction and then there's an assumption made and then it continues to build on that assumption when I feel like that assumption is false. I feel like there's part of me that just wants to clean up the one step before we move on to the next step and at least get on the same page, even if we disagree, just to like establish, okay, this is what you're saying, even though I disagree, like let's go on from here, assuming that you're right. But, and I know it could come off as me cutting people off and being rude, which I don't want to be. I want to be good at it. And it's tough because the conversations aren't in person and there's like this always little lag. There's something about a virtual conversation that's not quite real. And I find myself sometimes interjecting because I don't want to let the conversation go too far past the point that I either don't understand or don't agree with. I want to like linger there and work through it. And, you know, it's coming off like I'm arguing with people and it's not necessarily my intention. My intention is to like try to explore ideas that I think are interesting and get closer to the truth, whatever that is. And but through that, I'm like, hold on, what about this? You know, and I sound like maybe rude or whatever, which I don't want to be. But there's been a couple of those cases, and I talked to you about it, and you had an interesting take that it was kind of refreshing to hear. And it was something along lines of, like, I think you were, as my friend, like, glad to hear that I wasn't just letting people, like, say things on my podcast that just don't make sense to me without at least questioning it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you and I are both naturally very skeptical. And so I think sometimes, I think part of the problem is when you have a guest on, obviously their audience gets to see that too. And so their audience is already biased towards them. And so when they see someone like you, who they don't really know very much, like I would say, I don't know how your splits are, but like anytime I interview someone, maybe 20% of the views come from people that are actually subscribed to me. And then a bunch of the views come from the actual person that I'm talking to. So there's already a bias there. And then add into that, you're questioning their person that they really like. Now all of a sudden they get their pitchforks out. Who does this guy think he is? You know, this dude is the best thing since sliced bread. And, but I, that being said, from what I've listened to, you actually have a very, you have a sort of grace to it, because it's hard to cut people off. It is like, it's borderline impossible to cut people off without it sounding argumentative. Like, well, hold on a second. Sorry to interrupt you. Like, but I have to say something here. It's difficult to do it right. I actually think that you do a really good job of doing it in a way that is courteous. You pay the person a little bit of a compliment, and you know, like you tell them they're being a good sport about it, and that you're just naturally curious. You're not trying to argue with them. This is that and the third. So, despite what people might comment, and I think you do a good job. And also, that being said, like a podcast is not supposed to be a monologue. It is a dialogue between two people. You throw the ball to one person, the person throws the ball back, and you just keep that going. It shouldn't be just a 10-minute just spewing of all this information, and you know, you're desperately trying to like pick which thing, like, oh God, he just said like 10 different things to me. Which one do I actually focus in on here? And so, you know, I appreciate that as a listener, someone that I myself try to be evidence-based, who is also painfully aware of people just say all kinds of stuff that has absolutely no evidence behind it. Or if they did, if there is a study that exists to back up whatever it is that they're saying, it's like a very small scale study that like doesn't even say what they think it says if you really hammer down into it. I appreciate it when someone's like, well, hold on a second, can we hammer down on that point just a little bit, and can you expand on that, and here's been my experience with that. I'm actually pretty experienced, like the fasting video, like I know for a fact you have a ton of experience with fasting, so I was really happy to hear you push back against that, you know, as do I. And I would have said a lot of the same things that you did, because people just make this assumption that fasting is just good no matter what. Now I'm not saying it's bad, but there are cases in which it is bad, and so it's just important to, you know, inject all that nuance into it.
Yeah, that was an interesting episode. And I gotta tell you, I really liked that guy. I really liked Chris James. And I caught so much heat in the comment section about that. And half the comments were like just negative about me being a bad host and that I had no experience, even though in the conversation, I think I discussed my experience. I have years of experience of fasting. And, you know, one of the great things about Chris is that he doesn't really care about what people say about the physiology and what should happen, because he had his own experience. And I acknowledge like how important that is. And also it's true that he did, I feel like, lack some foundational like biochemical, you know, physiology understanding. So, which I think showed. So I had questions about some of that stuff, but man, did I get attacked. And maybe I'm reading into it too much, because the people that make negative comments in general are, it's more of a reflection of them and not so much me. Like, I don't generally get a lot of comments in general, but you know, when like 4 out of 5 are negative, it kind of stings me a little bit. But it's like, you know, like I was cast as like some enemy of the guy, and I'm like, I like the guy. I had him on and I really enjoyed talking to him. But yeah, I mean, what's that?
I was just going to say that I think people have it in their head that if you find someone a friend, it's hard for them to put a friend and criticism into the same bucket.
Before we begin today's episode, I want to share something really special with you, something I've been pouring my heart into. If you've been feeling tired in a way that sleep doesn't fix, if you've noticed you're carrying tension all the time, or you're stuck in that cycle of pushing, achieving, caring for everyone else, and running on empty, I've created something just for you. It's a weekend retreat called The Deep Unwind, and I'll be guiding it in person at the beautiful Art of Living Retreat Center in the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina. This experience is for the helpers, the overthinkers, the high achievers, the sensitive souls, the ones who are strong for everyone else, but craving a safe place to finally put down the heavy weight of responsibility and let their shoulders relax. Together, we'll spend the weekend slowing down and gently unwinding the patterns that lead to burnout and self-criticism. Through somatic practices, guided hypnotherapy, nervous system healing, and myofascial release, you'll learn how to feel safe in your body again. You'll learn how to soften your inner critic, and you'll experience how to truly rest, not just collapse or detach, but to deeply restore. You'll leave feeling lighter, clearer, more grounded, and more connected to yourself than you've felt in a long time. And everyone who joins us will receive a myofascial release kit with my favorite tools that I personally use and teach with, plus a signed copy of my book so you can continue the work at home. If this sounds like exactly what your nervous system has been asking for, I'd love to meet you there. You can learn more and reserve your spot at themindfulmovement.com/retreat. I look forward to welcoming you to The Deep Unwind.
If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you've probably heard me talk about how important it is to regulate your nervous system. This goes for healing, for focus, for just overall emotional well-being. But the reality is that even if we know the tools to help do this, whether it's breathing or meditation or just slowing down, it can still be really hard to stay regulated throughout a busy day. That's one reason I've really been interested in the Apollo wearable by Apollo Neuro. Sarah and I both use this device regularly and have found it very beneficial. It's a small wearable device that uses gentle vibrations, and they're designed to signal safety to your nervous system. What's fascinating is that those signals can help your body shift out of a stress state and into a calmer, more regulated state. What I like about it most of all is that even though it could work great alongside practices like meditation or breath work, the real value is that you can wear it throughout your day, even while you're at work, and just let it work its magic on your nervous system. The other standout use that I rely on is wearing it to bed. Not only does it help me fall asleep fast, but I often wake up around 3 a.m. and I can just tap the button on it and it will help lull me back to sleep quickly. If you want to learn more, check out the podcast episode with the founder, David Rabin, and you could explore more about the technology itself. But if you're someone that struggles with anxiety or feeling wired or overwhelmed, or you're simply looking for more nervous system support in daily life, it might be something worth exploring. You can learn more about the Apollo wearable and how it works and save $99 on a new device at apolloneuro.com/mindful or click the link in the show notes. I promise you won't regret this investment. I truly believe it's the best bang for the buck in the wellness tech space.
So like they see you criticizing him, they automatically assume you dislike him when that's not true. You know, like you can like someone and offer critique and offer pushback. I mean, I have a ton of friends, guy friends that I talk to on a regular basis, and we push each other quite a bit, but I love them. You know, like I have a lot of love for you. You and I have pushed each other in many different ways, very stressful conversations. I think that's just, I think there's just different types of people out there. You know, some people just categorize it as a fight, whereas other people are like, well, that's interesting. I haven't thought about it from that direction before. And, you know, like it's just growth to me.
Yeah. I wish the comment section was just a little bit more pleasant. I mean, I feel like one of the reasons I started a podcast is to connect and communicate with people. It started at a time where I felt like I had very little of that in my life. And I still do have very little of that in my life, I feel like. And I'm hoping, I want the comment section to be more of an area to discuss things in a healthy way. But so far, It's just very negative biased, and I'm not exactly sure how to facilitate more positivity and like more open-mindedness throughout that dialogue. But yeah, that was one that stood out. And then there was one. Actually, this is almost like a clarification. I feel like I have to say, I had another popular episode recently with a woman from Block Therapy that does this fascia work, which I thought some of it, I gave her, I feel like I gave her a lot of runway actually on things that didn't make sense to me. But there was one part where she talked about the anatomical design of like the human body and how our palms should go forward. And they should face forward when we're like standing, walking, running. And I asked her like why the fastest men in the world don't do that. Like if it was efficient, if it was effective, it would be done when there's like millions or hundreds of millions of dollars on the line. And she implied, well, they just don't know, which was just so absurd. But she said, look it up. It's the anatomical design. And I knew it wasn't correct, but I was just like, you know, let's just agree to disagree and move on. I didn't want to battle. But afterwards, I did look it up, and it does say it's the anatomical design. But what they mean by that is like, it's like for communication. It's like the way doctors can communicate, or you know, like
Superiorly, laterally,
where something
medially, all
is.
that
So
stuff.
like, so when there's a 2D picture of a human body, it's shown that way for like definition purposes. So you could
Uniformity.
describe, yeah, it's like a standardization, but it has nothing to do with how our arms are naturally supposed to swing. And it's absolutely incorrect. And I,
You
again,
know where I think that came from?
what's
I
that?
don't know if you ever heard this, but I think it was Kelly Starrett who started popularizing the idea of joint torque through external rotation forces. Do you ever hear any of this stuff back in the day? So like Olympic lifters screwing their feet into the ground, creating external
Oh,
rotation
sure.
torque at the
Yeah.
knee. And so I think he also popularized the idea of external rotation at the shoulder and how it creates torque at the shoulder too. I could be misremembering this, but I feel like it was just from that era. And I think a lot of people took it literally as your palms should be forward when that's not really what it is. It's more so just creating external rotation.
Yeah, there's a external rotation force. Yeah. I mean, Pavel Tsatsouline talked a lot about that through all his teachings around strength as like a skill and like the nuance and details of kind of the inner workings of the body when you're trying to generate force. Yeah, but I felt like, and maybe this is just my ego, I just felt like I had to get that off my chest. Like that is not correct. You should not strive to have your palms forward when you're going through your day. Is
Or
there,
walking, like,
yeah.
is that?
And just because there's a, and there's a, you know, if you have any experience with yoga, you know, mountain pose, I don't know the Sanskrit word for it, is very common, done in probably most yoga classes to some degree. Your palms are forward, and there's a reason for it, but it's not because that's the way we're supposed to just move through life. And if it was, I mean, this is the real test. If something is true in that regard, like you will see it at the highest level. Like when you see an Olympic lifter, like people don't realize how much skill and power is being expressed in Olympic lifting. And the body, in most cases, will default to the most efficient thing to get through because you have to, because you're not going to throw around competitive weight in that way if you don't. And that's where you see like the myths around like you shouldn't squat below parallel or all those stuff, like all goes out the window when you see the people that are the best in the world at it. And it also goes out the window when you watch 1-year-olds do it or 2-year-olds. You know, if you watch a 2-year-old squat, you'll see the knees flare out really wide, and like you'll see these things that are supposedly where there's like controversy around whether they're right. But when nobody's telling you what to do and you haven't been distorted by our culture and society and bad habits, and you do it. And then at the highest level, you see it also. And there's a lot to gain from that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually really happy you said that, 'cause another example of that is like Olympic marathoners. So like I've had someone talk about how you've heard of the 80-20 rule when it comes to 80% of your running should be easy. 20% of it should be done hard. Are you familiar with that?
Sure. Yeah.
So basically, for the listener, it's just the idea that, you know, if you do too much of your running too hard, you could increase your risk of injury and potentially even degrade performance. Run slow to run fast is what they say. But when you look at the best in the world, yes, they do a large amount of slow running, but their slow runs incorporate race miles in it. They're not just running 18 slow, super slow miles at like a 120 heart rate. They might do 2 miles slow and then 1 mile really hard and then do that like five times. So they're not following the 80-20 rule. And then in the same vein, those same people will also demonize carbohydrates and they'll be like, oh, well, the pros are doing this, this, this. And then you look at the pros like dietary strategy when it comes to fueling with carbohydrates, these guys are eating 90 grams of carbs per hour, you know? So it's like, if we straight up, dude, there's a study I just found the other day that was testing 120 grams per hour for mountain marathoners. And they actually had some really good results. Their rating of perceived exertion was lower and they had less markers of muscle damage throughout the race, like mainly creatine kinase. And there was a couple other markers, but it was much lower. Like, a lot lower.
Well, carbohydrates inherently will spare protein.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's because, for the listeners, that's just because if your carbohydrate level gets low relative to the demand of energy, your body will, modulated by hormones, stress hormones, will deteriorate your tissue, or it'll liberate tissue to make energy. And a big part of that is protein, from the protein in your body.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Let's talk about carbohydrates a little bit, because I also, man, I was just so combative. I mean, I had this recent guest on, and I didn't foresee it going that way, but, and I applaud him. You know, this is a man, Dr. Hawkins, that is trying to reverse diabetes, and that is a very noble task, 100%. And I know he's incentivized, and he has selfish reasons, but it's still like, it's good that there's people trying to do that. Yeah. But I felt like there was this cycle where he was demonizing carbohydrates. And I was like, well, I don't think it's the carbohydrates. And then he would say, well, it's everything. It's that, it's this, it's that. And I was like, well, if it's all those things, then it's not the carbohydrates. So if it's carbohydrates, it's that, then that's what it is. But you can't lump it in with all these other things and then say it's that. And it was a little frustrating, I think, for probably more so for him. But it was also frustrating for me. Like, I don't know necessarily how to navigate that through a virtual conversation to keep somebody, let's nail down this one aspect first. But then, you know, when I think about it since then, it's like I feel like if carbohydrates were the problem and cause diabetes, pretty much all or the vast majority of bodybuilders would be diabetic.
I would be 100%.
Yeah, let me ask you. I mean, for those that are listening and you can't see, I mean, Randall's ripped. Randall's ripped. He's very lean and lots of muscle. What's your? Give us some insight into what your macros look like.
Yeah, so I'm not as exact these days. Just as I've gotten more knowledge around it and figured out what works for me, I'm not really tracking diligently anymore. But typically, actually recently, I just increased my protein just out of curiosity, because, you know, there's people that say you should have a gram of protein per pound of body weight, which to me sounds really high and is a lot higher than the typical recommendations. But I said, screw it, let me try it out and just see. Definitely stronger. Definitely really? Stronger, like instantaneously stronger. I hit like 3 PRs in the past 3 weeks. Like,
did just you cut down any other like food group to accommodate it, or?
Yeah, I reduced my fat. So I really try to get lean cuts of meat when possible. Whereas before, because I had a little bit of wiggle room, because my protein was a little bit lower, you know, I would eat a ribeye here and there, not really worry about it. But now I'm like much more diligent about like boneless, skinless chicken thighs, really lean ground beef.
So do you think your overall energy intake is the same after you added protein?
Yeah, I mean, I have weight fluctuations for sure. Like, I was 189. I fluctuate between 185, 189. And so that kind of tells me
fluctuation.
Yeah, it's not much. And that could be water. Like, if I went on a really long run and I sweat a lot, you know, I could be 3 pounds lighter for a couple of days until I'm fully hydrated again. But yeah, in terms of carbohydrate, I don't monitor my fat intake, but my carb intake right now, I'm probably hovering at 300 grams of carbs. If I'm training for a race, that goes up to 400 easy, over 400.
Well, if you keep that up, you're clearly going to be diabetic.
So you know about my microdosing with prednisone. So on the topic, I know you're really big on the topic of stress and glucose and all that stuff. So for the listener, if you don't know what prednisone is, it is a glucocorticoid steroid that increases your cortisol. And one of the major side effects that are pretty much guaranteed at this point is that your blood sugar will spike hard. You could expect to see if someone took prednisone or was injected with a steroid in general, if they got their blood sugar tested the next day, it might be 150, 160, maybe even higher.
And that's because cortisol is driving gluconeogenesis. Yes.
Exactly.
Making more sugar.
Maybe not even potentially that, even just liberating muscle glycogen, any source that it can get it out. Because the whole purpose, as you know, of cortisol, evolutionarily speaking, is to move you into action, give you resources to move you into action so that you can hunt or, you know, whatever, pick berries, whatever food source. You eat the food, insulin spikes, insulin blunts cortisol directly. That's well known. And now you're no longer in a stress state. So it's not that eating carbs, well, we'll get to that in a minute. But so anyways, with a steroid, you would expect to see these massive spikes in blood sugar. In my case, I have a disease called ulcerative colitis. And one of the main forms of treating that is prednisone, initially acutely, like a large dose, and then they taper you off. I've been microdosing it, so 10 milligrams once a week. And not only has my blood sugar remained in the 80s, but that was also non-fasted. That was after eating. So, which is like a mind-blowing thing. You would expect to see someone that had eaten that day already on prednisone have a very high blood sugar.
Wait, reading. How long after eating? This is.
It was a few hours.
Okay, so it's after the post-meal.
Yeah, I hadn't just. Yeah. Either way, though, you would still expect someone on prednisone. And I believe I took prednisone the day before.
But that is arguably a pretty small dose, right?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. But people would still argue.
Okay.
People would still argue that you would still experience that because of the cortisol.
And you exercise a lot, which should drive cortisol in itself.
Exactly. Well, so and so I guess this speaks to how, you know, going back to your point about the guy that you interviewed and the type 2 diabetes, like in my case, I'm like doing everything wrong, according to these people that think carbohydrates cause type 2 diabetes. Like I should be a type 2 diabetic, but I'm far from it. I'm healthier than I've ever been. My blood sugar is like stellar. All my whole lipid profile is stellar. And it's because I'm eating carbohydrates, and I will take that to the bank. Like another side effect of prednisone is insomnia, steroid-induced insomnia. I sleep like a baby. You know when I don't sleep like a baby? When I don't eat enough carbs. And I've seen that time and time again, especially like if I run and I don't fuel properly, let's say I have a busy day and I don't eat enough carbohydrates, my sleep suffers that day. I wake up every couple of hours. I'm just like on edge. You know, I can just feel the cortisol just trying to move me into action.
Do you feel, Randall, that when you're eating carbs intentionally to make sure that you've kind of helped recover from your workout, whether it's repleting glycogen or stores, do you feel that the timing of those carbs is important to affect the quality of your sleep? Like, do you need to eat carbs the last meal of the day or late to ensure you're getting good sleep? Or is it as long as you get enough at some point in the day, you're okay?
I suspect it's the late night dinner carbs that are having the biggest impacts. I don't know. Maybe it could be that very large insulin spike right before bed kind of carries me through the night, making sure my cortisol doesn't spike. That makes sense to me, but that's not an experiment that I've tried where I've tried to get all my carbs way earlier. Gotcha. And then
Do you feel like the 300 to 400, I mean, on average, it sounds like you average 300 grams of carbs a day,
yeah.
Which for some people sounds crazy, but it's actually not. It's like, if you just do the math, it's just not crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy if you're, you know, totally sedentary maybe, but is that generally spread out over three meals? Like, how are you spreading out 300?
I typically eat four meals, actually, and I drink juice. So really simple body armors. I know, everyone's like, processed food.
So yeah, you're getting basically 75 grams four times, give or take, four times.
Yeah, and maybe a little bit less, and then filling in the gaps with body armor drinks. Just juice whenever possible.
Listeners, people don't realize this. Like, I've done math on the whiteboard for many of my clients over the years at the gym. They don't understand how much sugar we need. Now, granted, you're active. Like, you might not need as much as Randall. But just to get a visual, that's like 15 teaspoons of sugar. If it was just in the form of sugar, I'm sure it comes in the form of, you know, starches and other kind of carbohydrates and fruits and juices, like you said. But just to get a visual, imagine taking a teaspoon and filling it 15 times of pure cane sugar. He's doing that four times a day.
Yeah.
Four times a day, you're having 15 teaspoons of sugar. And you're not diabetic. You feel great. You sleep great. And you're ripped. Now, you do mention you have ulcerative colitis. And, you know, my brain, and the way I hear you say that, just as a friend, like, as if it has you. And my brain would not want to stop exploring, you know, what's driving that. But I'm not going to pick on you for that now. But my point is saying is, like, you're not perfect.
No.
But it doesn't seem like the 15 teaspoons of sugar four times a day is problematic.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. Like, I don't have it all figured out. I've had this disease since I was a teenager. You know, it's been a long, arduous, just experimenting type journey, trying different diets, different protocols. And honestly, the best it's been is when I'm eating simple carbohydrates and supplementing fibers. So, like, I have to be careful about certain vegetables that I eat. Some people might say, eat more vegetables. You have colitis. You need more vegetables. Well, hold on a second. Like, if I ate kale or like spinach or something like that, that's going to mess me up for a couple days. Like, it's not that simple. If I do eat vegetables like that, they have to be really overcooked, really soft. Because otherwise it's like razor blades going through my system. And so one of the biggest effects for people with ulcerative colitis is malnutrition. They can't absorb the food that they're eating, not to mention they're taking so many trips to the bathroom, they can't even eat in the first place. And so for me, simple carbohydrates has made it really easy to gain weight again. I mean, I lost a lot of weight. I think I mentioned it to you before in passing about how the last time I came up to Maryland, I was actually going through a really hard flare up and I had lost a lot of weight. I mean, I was down to like 167, 165 pounds, which for me is very light. Like, I'm almost 190 right now. So imagine, you know, me 30 pounds lighter than I am. And it was because I was malnourished. I couldn't eat.
Yeah. You look scrawny. I felt like I could have beaten you up then at that time.
You probably could have, man. Yeah. I was really skinny.
I was thinking about it. I was like, vulnerable. You know, this might be my one chance to beat up Randall. He's really looking scrawny.
Yeah. Yeah, man. It was bad.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, you know, when you say simple carbs, like for me personally, I think that the sugars, the simple things, the things that digest really quick are generally better. And I think that's probably going to be the case for a lot of people that have gut issues. Like, I think if you have gut issues, there's a good chance that there's some kind of dysbiotic stuff going on. And I don't think there's really a great way to qualify that yet. I've heard so much like reason to think a lot of the testing is kind of useless, but people generally know if their guts aren't great. And in my experience, the less fiber, like when you say you have to be careful with fiber, I mean, my curiosity would be like, eliminate it for a little while. Like, get as much carbs as you can with as absolute least amount of fiber. Like, the sugary things that your body doesn't have to do any work to just make energy out of and let the guts rest. For me, that seems to do better. Like, I could take a glass of orange juice and add 2 heaping tablespoons of sugar to it to supplement my meal. Or like, this might sound gross to some people, but my breakfast today, I brown some like grass-fed ground beef and I add half a dozen pastured eggs. I don't eat all this at once. I just made it, you know, 2 or 3 servings for me. I just cook that in a pan. I put it in a bowl and then I smother it with maple syrup. And I mean smother it. So I'm getting my protein, my fat, and I'm getting carbohydrate, but I'm getting it with no gut stress.
How do you feel after you eat that?
I feel great. Like, I feel
really
great right now. But I love breads. But I have to be honest that even if I, like, I'll, I know that if I eat homemade sourdough bread, I handle it better than, like, store-bought bread. But if I eat it, my problem is, like, I'll make it, and then I'll make, like, 3 loaves over, like, 10 days or something, and, like, I'm living on it. With that, like, every meal, I'm having some, and then after, like, the fourth day of that, it's like, oh, my guts are problematic. But anything that's, like, that has a lot of, like, fibrous material, which is supposed to be good for us, doesn't do me as well as just straight sugar. Like, starches don't do – I don't do well with them compared to sugar, and I think it has to do with the fact that a starch is basically a bunch of glucoses attached that your body has to break down. So it winds up just getting farther and farther down the digestive tract, more likely to encounter all the world of microbes that you might not want to be feeding. It's not inherently good to just feed your gut microbiome, unless maybe you have like a really good microbiome. But growing up in this country, getting antibiotics a half a dozen times, getting them a bunch for Lyme disease, you know, drinking alcohol for a couple decades, like, I'm sure my microbiome is not like the some great microbiome. Like, I don't want to be just feeding it blindly as much as it wants. I want to feed me.
Yeah. Yeah. You said a lot there. I think let's double click on the fiber point. So how do you feel about the idea of fiber binding to certain toxins and stuff and carrying it out of the body? Like, if you're going really low complex carbohydrate, I mean, logically it would follow that your stools would be kind of small, non-existent, not really able to, there's no like bindable material there anymore.
Yeah. I haven't seen that. I find that dairy seems to, I do like dairy and I have it daily, and dairy, whether it's milk, kefir, cheese, like I have it all, and ice cream. And I don't seem to have a problem with volume. I get it. I do think that fiber has a role in binding toxins, binding endotoxin, taking, like, I guess, excess cholesterol out of the body. And I don't know where that balance is. Like, for me, the things that, like, there's been times where I've had, like, popcorn, you know, like movie night, have a bowl of popcorn, where it's really felt like it's been useful in that specific regard. Like, I really feel like it's acted as, like, a binder. But my problem, again, is, like, it'll feel good, so I'll do it, like, 3 nights in a row, and then it's like, oh, now I'm just irritated. Like, my guts are, like, maybe if I had it once a week, it would serve that purpose. Like, I don't know how much material we need to bind. I would argue that the less you feed the bacteria in your guts, the less endotoxin you're going to be creating, the less need there is to bind endotoxin to take it out.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. How do we know which gut bacteria are actually producing endotoxin as opposed to, like, the quote-unquote good bacteria that produce butyrate and all that other good stuff, supposedly?
Well, I think they still produce toxin as they go through their life cycle. It's not necessarily their metabolic products. It's like, I think it's the actual parts of the cells they're made of as they degrade, as they're just expiring because they have short life cycles. So, like, every day there's massive amounts of death occurring through the microbiome. I mean, your stool is essentially fiber, death, and dead bacteria, like all this dead stuff. So, I don't know. It's a good question, but I think, and there's probably a lot of individual variability, but I think there's reason that if you don't feel good and you think your guts aren't 100% and they feel tender, they feel iffy, or there's just something not right, it's a worthy thing to tinker with. Of, like, what is it like if I dramatically reduce my fiber? The good thing is, and by the way, in the world of GI, low FODMAP diet is dished out really early now as a, like, a standard practice to try first, as a first, which is basically saying stop feeding bacteria. And the reason why it's dished out is because it's really effective. Like it has a really high rate of reducing symptoms. So it's definitely worth trying. You're not going to like damn yourself if you don't eat fiber for a week or two. If it feels like it's not the right thing, you could just add it back in. But the good thing is I think most people, if it does help them, they'll know soon. I don't think you have to go low fiber for like 3 months to see if it's moving the needle. I mean, when my fiber's up for like consistently and I'm starting to get like the bloat or whatever, if I cut it out dramatically, within like 24 hours, it's like, oh, it's going away. Like, it's like magic.
No, I really like that your popcorn example, and you acknowledge you don't know where the balance is and individual, variability. Like for me, I have experimented with fiber and I find I do really bad on no fiber. I don't know if it's just perhaps the binding to toxins thing, so maybe there's like stuff down there that's just getting, it's just sitting there. But I supplement with psyllium husk. And I do get a small amount of vegetables. And so, to your point, like, what is the balance? How much is too much? How much is just enough? And that's up to the individual to experiment. And for me, like, just adding a little bit of psyllium husk to my protein shakes and having some greens, a reasonable amount with dinner, seems to be great for me. Like, to me, I'm just like, I'm thinking about giving myself enough to form my stools, and that's it. And I'm not going overboard because, to your point, like popcorn, if I eat popcorn, that's razor blades to me. I can't eat that. And I would imagine, even for a regular person, if they're just slamming popcorn all the time, it is literally like razor blades, the shells, those like brown shells that go through you. Yeah,
Yeah,
that's
especially
going
if
to
you
tear
have an
through.
irritated gut. I mean, what do they say when you if you have diverticulosis or diverticulitis, or I mean, they say don't eat nuts, seeds, like any little hard thing. So there's, a lot of people probably do well not eating a lot of that stuff. Popcorn, nuts, seeds, anything that are little hard things that don't become your body. Your body doesn't take that and make parts with it. It's really just like, I got to get this stuff out. But on its way out, it can be problematic. Yeah, and psyllium husk, from what I understand, is a pretty well tolerated fiber that I think has been used for a long time. I think there's a lot of history with psyllium husk. It's
That was
like
one of the
powdered
biggest.
cardboard or something, basically.
Yeah, basically, it's just powdered fiber. That was one of the most powerful things that I added to my diet. That's helped a lot. But yeah, to your point about the nuts and seeds, like I'm a really big proponent of food journaling, as I'm sure you are too. And there are, like, I think the moral of the story of what we're talking about here with individual variability is like you don't know unless you experiment and write it down and like actually track the stuff. Because I've told you before, I used to eat almonds all the time. I used to eat avocados all the time. And when I started food journaling, I can't eat those foods. I don't know why, but I just can't eat them. My stomach, like, I can do a little bit of avocado. If I do a full half, I'm gonna have a bad time. I can't eat almonds at all. I think most nuts and seeds are basically off limits for me now. Maybe for the fiber reason, I don't know. But it's you have to experiment and
Well,
see what works for you.
let me ask you then, other than juice, well, one, I wonder how much juice you're having. What are these 300 grams of carbs you're having?
Before we begin today's episode, I want to share something really special with you, something I've been pouring my heart into. If you've been feeling tired in a way that sleep doesn't fix, if you've noticed you're carrying tension all the time, or you're stuck in that cycle of pushing, achieving, caring for everyone else, and running on empty, I've created something just for you. It's a weekend retreat called The Deep Unwind, and I'll be guiding it in person at the beautiful Art of Living Retreat Center in the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina. This experience is for the helpers, the overthinkers, the high achievers, the sensitive souls, the ones who are strong for everyone else, but craving a safe place to finally put down the heavy weight of responsibility and let their shoulders relax. Together, we'll spend the weekend slowing down and gently unwinding the patterns that lead to burnout and self-criticism. Through somatic practices, guided hypnotherapy, nervous system healing, and myofascial release, you'll learn how to feel safe in your body again. You'll learn how to soften your inner critic, and you'll experience how to truly rest, not just collapse or detach, but to deeply restore. You'll leave feeling lighter, clearer, more grounded, and more connected to yourself than you've felt in a long time. And everyone who joins us will receive a myofascial release kit with my favorite tools that I personally use and teach with, plus a signed copy of my book so you can continue the work at home. If this sounds like exactly what your nervous system has been asking for, I'd love to meet you there. You can learn more and reserve your spot at themindfulmovement.com/retreat. I look forward to welcoming you to the deep unwind.
If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you've probably heard me talk about how important it is to regulate your nervous system. This goes for healing, for focus, for just overall emotional well-being. But the reality is that even if we know the tools to help do this, whether it's breathing or meditation or just slowing down, it can still be really hard to stay regulated throughout a busy day. That's one reason I've really been interested in the Apollo Wearable by Apollo Neuro. Sarah and I both use this device regularly and have found it very beneficial. It's a small wearable device that uses gentle vibrations, and they're designed to signal safety to your nervous system. What's fascinating is that those signals can help your body shift out of a stress state and into a calmer, more regulated state. What I like about it, most of all, is that even though it can work great alongside practices like meditation or breath work, the real value is that you can wear it throughout your day, even while you're at work, and just let it work its magic on your nervous system. The other standout use that I rely on is wearing it to bed. Not only does it help me fall asleep fast, but I often wake up around 3 a.m. and I can just tap the button on it and it will help lull me back to sleep quickly. If you want to learn more, check out the podcast episode with the founder, David Rabin, and you could explore more about the technology itself. But if you're someone that struggles with anxiety or feeling wired or overwhelmed, or you're simply looking for more nervous system support in daily life, it might be something worth exploring. You can learn more about the Apollo Wearable and how it works and save $99 on a new device at apolloneuro.com/mindful or click the link in the show notes. I promise you won't regret this investment. I truly believe it's the best bang for the buck in the wellness tech space.
Yeah. So last night, for example, I have a crock pot dish that I make that's boneless, skinless chicken thighs with potatoes and carrots. I do well with potatoes as long as they're cooked enough, softer type potatoes. I'll do long grain white rice.
Do you leave the skin on the potatoes?
I do. Yeah. I'm lazy like that. But I know you're not a fan of the pesticides soaking up all
just
the...
Wondered. Well, I think they're a higher concentration of all kinds of toxins. So I'm just wondering.
Sure.
Like, I remember I had a client in the gym. I want to hold that. I want to come right back to where you were talking. But I had a client who's Asian, who spent most of his life in China. And he was in... And he's a restaurant owner, owns a bunch of sushi restaurants in the area. And I saw him. He was just hanging out. And he's, like, eating a peeled sweet potato. And I was like, I noticed you don't eat the skin. He's like, he looked at me, he's like, eat the skin? Like, nobody eats the skin. You can't eat the skin of a potato. It was interesting. And I was like, in America, they eat them all the time. You can go to a bar and they'll sell potato skins as an appetizer. And he thought it was crazy. And I was like, that's
interesting. What was his rationale?
Well, he's from an older culture that's been around a long time that know that there's a high concentration of toxins in the skin. They avoid them.
Are those toxins from the pesticides, or are they?
I think they're inherent. I think they're the toxins that basically protect the potato. Think about where a potato grows. Have you ever grown potatoes? I mean,
no.
They're underground, so they're exposed. So think it's a dark, moist environment. So you have, maybe subject to maybe a moldy environment. You have critters that want to access it. Like, if they weren't protected with toxins, then all the bugs in the ground would eat them. It would just be food. There's glucose in it. There's all kinds of things that would want to eat it. But they don't, because it's got a protective layer. I think it's high in oxalate, too, the skin. So there are things in there that help protect that root or tuber or whatever it is. Yeah, and so other cultures, they don't eat it. Like, from what I understand, in Italy, they don't eat tomato skins. because they're high in seeds, but we
Interesting.
do because we're like Americans are lazy and
We're
we think we
American.
know everything. But anyway, I want to revert back. So
Yeah.
you have crock pot dish. So
Yeah, so softer potatoes. I'll eat rice, just long grain white rice. Recently, I've been doing protein pasta. So it's, I think it's Barilla is the brand name. It's just extra protein. It has like 16 grams of protein per 3.5 ounce serving, something like that.
But that protein
Bananas.
is from the wheat, so that's got like a higher gluten content then, or
That's
probably.
a good question. I don't know if they mix animal protein in it or not. I would venture to guess not. It's probably pea protein or something like that. Actually, I feel like I did look at it, and I'll tell you off air. I'll remind myself, but I feel like they added something to it, not just more wheat. But yeah, then there's fruit, softer fruit, oranges, bananas. I can't eat kiwis. There's a lot of
Excellent.
fruit.
I wonder if that's why.
Yeah, like berries, I don't do so well with. So basically just softer fruit. And then there's juice of all kind. It's really simple. It's a really bland diet,
What kind of
it's
juices?
nothing crazy. The
Oh.
BodyArmors and
Oh.
occasionally like
Wait, is
grape
that real
juice.
juice? Body armor?
Yeah, it says it's made with real juice. I
Maybe.
mean, who knows
Says
though?
maybe. I've never had a body armor. So you don't just get
Yeah.
like orange juice.
No.
Like real juice. Okay.
No, I feel like so some of those juices, so I've made the mistake before of like chugging some blueberry juice before I had a run and I almost shit my pants. So, like you do
I
have to
wish
be
I was there to
careful
laugh at
about
you. Okay.
you have to be careful about like what juice it is because certain juices do have downstream effects. BodyArmor, I seem to tolerate it really well. It has electrolytes in it, it has other micronutrients, vitamin C, a bunch of different vitamins. So yeah, it checks a bunch of boxes.
Don't you just start growing body armor trees and pick your own body armor fruit?
I do want to eventually, I would like to get a place where I have my own chickens and my own farm and all that stuff, garden, potatoes, tomatoes, all that stuff. But that's a ways down the
I
road.
gotta ask you, with the history of the UC, have you ever done the gluten-free to see if that moved the needle?
I've done carnivore. And
That
that
would be
sucked.
gluten-free. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I meant by when I fully eliminated fiber,
Gotcha.
it was, yeah, that's when it was bad. So yeah. Again, I don't know. Like to me, what seems to be the best is when I do have relatively well-formed stools. Symptoms just seem to go away. And then when I stop doing that and my diet kind of turns into a lot more meat and stuff like that, a lot more fat, then things start to go downhill again. I think it's something to do with fat, but I don't know. I couldn't hammer it down.
Maybe. I mean, a lot of people have issues with fat,
Yeah.
not producing enough bile to handle it, or who knows.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, that I didn't really expect us to talk so much about that, but I like to
It's all
hear
good.
your insights. While I have you on, and you're such a fitness guy, let's talk a little bit about something fitness related. I had posed a question to you kind of in passing a while back about kind of like sets, reps, program, volume. I've been exploring a program that's kind of new for me that I've really been enjoying. And but I also I it's a new, I'm not used to these types of strength training routines. It's a variation of like a push-pull leg thing, and I was inspired by some guy on Instagram who's like, or YouTube, who's like way younger than me. Which like I probably shouldn't be taking fitness advice from or getting, but it was just inspiring me, like the way, like his attitude, his mindset about how he approached it. I was like, I like this guy. I'm gonna just try what he's doing. But
Yeah.
it was like he was like extreme. It was like 10 by 10 of freaking everything of like big lifts, and I was like, well, that's not gonna
No.
happen for me. But I started doing it, and I've been doing it. And it's going fairly well. Like I'm definitely getting stronger and I put on some muscle, which is nice because I'm 48. It's like, okay, you could still put on muscle. But sometimes I feel like I'm overdoing it and I don't know if I should just add more days. Like there's part of me that doesn't want to skip days and have too many days off because then I feel like I'm going so long between the days because each day I have like a focal lift. And I don't want to go 10 days instead of 7 before I do it again. Like Like, I have a fear of losing my gains, which I know, like, I know is a ridiculous thing. I know my ego's like getting in the way. Like, I know that's not true. I know I'm not going to lose strength that fast. But I wanted to just get your take on like how to approach the idea of recovery. And like, how do you manage it, monitor it? How do you listen to the signals of your body, whether you're getting enough or if you're not pushing yourself enough?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you and I have kind of in brief passing discussed, well, brought up maximum recoverable volume. And to me, that's not like a, that's not a scientific term that has a bunch of evidence behind it. Really what the idea is that if you could imagine a line and what it represents is the quality of your work capacity. So if the line's going across, up would be your work capacity is increased, down would be your work capacity is decreased. So training stimulus on one end, inevitably, as you train, your work capacity will drop, right? That's, you've stressed yourself out. The day after, you're going to be, if you tried to do the same workout the next day, you'd be a little bit weaker. You'd be tired. You might be sore, achy. Eventually, you come back up to baseline. You've crossed that line. And hopefully, the adaptation happens and you're a little bit better. You're a little bit stronger. Your muscles have grown a little bit, whatever. So to me, when I'm doing lifts, I'm looking at, are my lifts at the very... Are my lifts at least staying the same or even improving? If they are, then I know I have found a frequency that works for me. And within reason, of course, taking into account achy joints, all that stuff too. Your sleep could be disrupted. So these are all things to like take into account as well. Like, yeah, you might be getting stronger, but then all of a sudden your sleep's like super disrupted. Okay, that's an indicator that maybe you've pushed too hard too frequently. But for me, I'm just paying attention to what are my lifts doing. So I write down all of my lifts, all the weight, all the reps that I'm doing. And
do
if
you
it's
build,
at least staying this,
I'm sorry, do you build in any like built in recovery days while you're still lifting? Like if you're used to doing three sets of eight of 175 for something, do you like build in every 5, 8, 10 weeks, like pull it back to 60% so you could just keep going?
Yeah.
Or do you just keep pressing every week?
So you're talking about like a mesocycle type idea where, you know, you go for 6 weeks. So for the listener, you have like microcycles, macrocycles, and mesocycles. A mesocycle would basically like what Les is talking about is like pushing really hard for 6 weeks and then you dial it back, let the adaptation happen, and then you push even higher the next time. So for me, I try to dial it back if I've hit a really hard PR. So the last deadlift PR I hit was 370 for three, and that was hard. That third rep was very slow, and I just noticed that if I don't dial it back after something like that, typically a couple days later it comes with an injury, a knee thing, a lower back thing, and so I've just learned over time to just restart the cycle at that point and go. But in terms of on a macro scale, I don't have any rest days programmed in. So I follow a push legs, pull run program, and it just keeps repeating. So each week is going to look different. Your push isn't always going to be on the same day. I know that drives some people crazy, but that way, if I do happen to wake up one day and I'm super beat up, then okay, yeah, I'll take a rest day that day. I might take a walk, but I'm not planning out recovery days because I take, are you familiar with Mike Mentzer, the famous bodybuilder, the less is more? Yeah. So for the listener, if you're not familiar, he's a very famous bodybuilder who, you know, was really big on high quality stimulus, like training really hard, but you're not doing a lot. You might do one really, really hard set. You're in the gym for like 30 minutes and then you get out and then you rest for 3 days. So I've kind of borrowed from his approach a little bit where I'm not doing 10 sets. I'm not doing 5 sets. I do 2 hard sets. One is heavy for 3 to 5 reps and one is light for 8 to 15, who knows what it could be. And then I'm done with that exercise and then I move on to the next one. I don't spend a lot of time there. And because I'm doing less volume within session, I'm getting more frequency. So I'm hitting each day 1.5 times a week. And because I'm only hitting each exercise twice, there's not much to recover from.
So you're doing the push, leg, pull, run.
Yes.
And then repeat, like no days off in between. So every day.
Nope.
Okay, yeah. So I guess when you're doing it like that, it's really important to not do too much stress on any one thing.
Yes. I feel like, especially.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I would not encourage a newbie, if someone's listening right now and like, that sounds like a really cool program, I would not encourage a newbie to start with what I'm describing. I would say upper body, lower body split with a couple runs sprinkled in through there each week is probably a better idea for someone that's
or you might be able to do the same thing, just put a day in between, rest between every one, and just go push, rest, leg, rest, pull, rest, run, rest. The Mike Mentzer thing, I remember binging on his content a few years back, and it's wild and interesting. And he's also, I think, was juiced, so you got to have that context. But it was like the problem I had with that idea is that, like, it keeps you out of the gym. So, like, I like going to the gym. Like, I like exercising. I have the time to do it. It's like my sanctuary. So I don't want to – like, I don't know what to do with myself in a day where I have no physical activity scheduled or whatever.
I relate with that a lot. And, you know, the solution that I've found, which is why I've kind of borrowed pieces from him and kind of made it my own. But, you know, I know one thing that gets frustrating to some people that listen to me is that I very rarely will hand out definitive prescriptions to people on how much they should do. Like in terms of how many sets you should do, the evidence says 1 to 3. So I'm not going to tell you to do 3. I'm going to tell you, hey, there's some freedom there. You can do whatever you want to do. In terms of rep schemes, it for like maximal hypertrophy, the evidence says 5 to 35. So I'm not going to tell someone to do 20 reps. I'm going to say, hey, do you like to do 20 reps? Okay, do 20 reps. You know, so I think there's some freedom in there. And I think that freedom is what liberates me to be able to make a program that I just very much enjoy doing. Like, to your point, I very much look forward to training every day, which is why I train every day as hard as I do, you know. So I hear you when you say, like, it would keep you out of the gym too long, you know, but there's freedom there, man. You could do whatever you want. And that's where maximum recoverable volume comes into play, where you're kind of taking note of, like, what is my performance doing? Is it dipping? Okay, maybe I'm pushing, maybe this program is a little much for me, but if you're like at least hitting baseline and then some on some of your days, I mean, full steam ahead, man, you know?
Gotcha. Yeah, I feel like for the recovery right now, what I'm doing, which I think I need to be more structured about, is I'm just listening, and if things feel like I don't physically feel pushing myself to the level I usually do, I just take like a play day where I roll around, I do lots of like, general mobility, feel good, like soft tissue work, sauna, maybe get a massage, lots of walking maybe. And I just wait. And then usually it makes me feel really good. The next day I'm like really ready to go. But I feel like I might need more of that. Like I'm doing that maybe one day a week, and because I'm stubborn or stupid or whatever. And because I'm doing a push pull leg thing where it's like, and I have like little accessory lifts each day, but it's
actually, yeah. Could you like lay it out?
Sure.
For me,
I'm basically doing, right now, like push. So I got a nice new barbell set at my house. So I'm kind of playing with the new toy. So, I'm benching for the first time in years. So I'm like benching and doing dips one day. And while I'm doing that, I'm always working in like mobility work, quality work. I might be doing just kind of like nourishing the rotator cuff, all that kind of stuff. And then the next day I'm doing pull-up focused. So I'm doing a handful of sets of pull-ups with varying loads. Then I'm doing squatting the next day. Then I'm doing overhead presses the next day, horizontal pulling, and then hinging. So I was doing deadlift. Now I'm doing a little bit more single leg deadlift and kettlebell based hinges and a little bit of plyometric stuff.
Can we take a step back real quick? So you're doing push pull legs. Are you just repeating after legs? Push pull legs, push pull legs.
I'm doing push pull leg, but so each week there's one push is horizontal in nature and downward, I guess. And one of the push days is overhead.
Okay.
So I'm doing like a horizontal push, then vertical pull, then squats, then a vertical push, horizontal pull, and deadlifts.
I got
And then like a play day where I'm literally like dancing. I'm turning the music up. I got the sauna cooking ready for me. I'm rolling around. I'm literally doing stuff that I wouldn't be caught doing in public because I'd be too embarrassed. I'm doing cartwheels. I'm doing fun. I'm trying to be childlike. and having fun.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, that's, I think I get that from rock
But what
climbing.
I've noticed, and where I think I'm not acting my age and probably need someone to say, "Hey man, you're being an idiot, do this," is because it's like different muscle group focus, which is kind of new for me. Like, you know me going back, I've always been very movement focused and not so much muscle focused, but I'm kind of enjoying the muscle focus now and I'm combining the movement focus with it. But it's like, because I pushed yesterday, I should be able to pull today because those muscles aren't sore. They don't feel like they need to be recovered. My pull-ups feel fine because I haven't done them in, 7, 8 days. But I think I'm not giving enough respect to the general recovery, like the central nervous
Systemic
system,
recovery.
maybe. So I think I need to work more recovery in and like get out of the what like a pro like it's a 1 week program, and like that's an arbitrary number, 7 days. Like, yeah, we have a calendar that has a bunch of weeks on it, but nowhere does it say your program should link up with this man-made calendar. And I'm like, if this was a 9 day schedule and I didn't care what day of the week, and I got that out of my head and I had one or two more of those play days, I think it'd be better for me.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. That's exactly why I do a 4 day schedule, because it doesn't matter, if push is on Monday or whatever.
But you're doing it
But
consecutively. You're not doing 4 days every 7 days.
yeah, but I'm just making the point
Oh.
that it doesn't matter, that if it is on a 7 day cycle, you could do
Oh.
more frequency, you can do less
Gotcha.
frequency, it doesn't really matter. But to your point about, if you do push, you should be able to do pull. That's why I have legs in between push and pull. Because yes, it is different muscles, but I mean, your upper body's still going to be pretty fatigued going from a push day directly into a pull day the next day. And even sometimes, like if I do heavy deadlifts, my back is sort of lit up going into a pull day, so I have to be careful there as well. But yeah, I mean, to me, it's make a program that you like and monitor your performance. And if it's It like it could be push legs, so it could be play push legs pull play, so it could be like a 5 day split, and then maybe an off day for on the sixth day, and then rinse and repeat, and just whatever, something like that. But that's where my mind would go, is putting legs in between push and pull, and then having your play days outside of that.
Maybe the push and pull does, because I think I'm having the most fun and success with those. I feel like I'm going the hardest on those 2 days, and maybe I do need to plug a recovery in between them.
Yeah, I mean, do you
So
notice your performance? Well,
I think
I mean,
where I
it doesn't
notice it
sound
in
like.
like general stress, like sleep disturbance, I think is a big one. And maybe it's like, maybe I need to have a whole nother serving of carbs that night.
I was just about to say more sugar,
And
man.
maybe, but like, when I started adding carbs a few years ago, I gained a lot of weight because I didn't cut anything else out. And
Exactly.
now I've turned it around and it's coming back down. And I'm like, I like this. This feels good that it's coming down. And so I don't want to mess with that. And I don't know where that line is. Like, the scale's coming down slowly, which I think is the right way to do it, and I want to be disciplined and keep it coming down slowly. So yeah, maybe more carbs, but I think the more responsible, wiser thing to do, which is really hard for me to do, so I'm saying it out loud here to put it out in the world and maybe hold myself accountable, is to just plug in at least one more. Like, I could start by just plugging in one intentional rest day, turn my 7 day routine into eight. And then, even if I give myself flexibility where it's like either between the push and pull or after that pull before I hit the leg day, where I'm just getting another day where there's no agenda but to nourish and fill my cup and not pour from the cup.
Sure. Do you ever feel beat up in that, like your achy, sore, things of that nature? Is that a contributor?
To tie it back to nutrition, the thing that makes me feel more achy is when my nutrition's off. Like, I am
Sure.
amazed how I could turn on or off back pain with foods. So like if I am eating clean and I'm like really low on fiber and my guts feel calm, it doesn't seem like exercise ever makes anything ache. I just feel good. I just know that I can still do it, and then I'll just feel like tired more than I should be. Like I just want to rest, or I'll get up at 3 in the morning and I can't get back to sleep easily. Like that's how it shows up. But with the achiness, I really feel like my aches are not exercise induced, unless it's just like injury. Like, oh, I overdid something. I really injured something, which is pretty rare.
Yeah. No, I relate with that big time. Recent, well, not recent, somewhat recent revelation is pizza for me. So I love pizza, but I can't eat it. My back goes out like clockwork. It's like, it's the funniest thing, man. I don't know why. I don't know what it is about pizza specifically, and doesn't matter where it comes from. But if I eat pizza the next day, if I have like a leg day, it's pretty guaranteed that my back's going to be feeling
Well,
pretty
it's
bad
funny because
afterwards.
pizza's loaded with oxalate generally, and you said kiwis and berries, which are loaded in oxalate, don't agree with you. It could be that's the underlying inflammatory thing. You might want to look at where else you're having oxalates. Like maybe it is the potatoes.
Yeah.
Potatoes are high oxalate. You could reduce them if you cook them in water, but you got to remove the water. That like when I make
Yeah.
potatoes, I'll make them mashed because you're dramatically reducing the oxalate load. But I know we've talked about this in the past. I mean, the spine, which is loaded with nerves that a lot of people will get, pain sense signals from, is what, an inch away, if that, from the intestine. Like if your intestines are inflamed, I mean, this is the way I think about it. If you slice yourself with a razor on the arm, the actual cut could be like a fraction of a millimeter, but the inflamed area could be like an inch or two wide. So just
Yeah.
think about that. Like think about if your intestine, this garden hose, is inflamed, imagine it puffy and red, and of course, and there's no big gaps of nothing in there. Everything's like tightly packed. So
Yeah.
whatever's nearby as the crow flies is likely getting some effect from that.
Yeah. No, you're right. And that's something that I talked about in an ulcerative colitis video. I like to use the analogy of like a balloon, whereas when your guts are nice and healthy, it's like a deflated balloon and there's like space in there. But when you eat, let's just say pizza, now it's like an inflated balloon. And to your point, there's not much space in there. So, you could imagine all of that stuff spreading out, not only, getting really close to the nerves of the spine, but also inhibiting the core, the muscles of the trunk and the core. If you have something pressing outwards, your ability to create intra-abdominal pressure is going to be affected. Your ability for all those muscles in there to turn on at will is reduced. So I fully believe that's a big part of it, is just the inflammatory response, shutting my, I guess, stability down, my spine's
Yeah, it's
ability
interesting
to
because I mean,
stabilize.
anybody could relate to this if you've had an injury. Like, when you get an injury, things don't work. Like, you have to go to re like, if you get a rotator cuff tear, like, you have all this down regulation. It's like your body trying to protect you by saying, don't use this. And all these
Yeah.
muscles shut down. But we're idiots. We go in and we have a routine that we want to stick to in the gym, so we want to use it. But yeah, it's like inhibited. So all these the supporting cast of your primary muscles that are doing the global movements, all these little stability things that we rely on to be safe are like compromised in the inflamed
Yeah.
state because they're literally
Yeah.
trying to shut down because they don't want you doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a big problem, but now I don't eat it, and to be honest with you, it's I haven't had back pain ever since.
Oh,
So
wow.
yeah. I know, man. It's really hard to say no to it sometimes, but we're human, right? Like we can't be perfect. I just made a video about this. That's what the today's video is about. 80-20 rule. Binge eating behavior, people that try to eat too clean end up eating the food anyway, and usually in larger amounts than if they had just allowed themselves to eat a little bit
Right.
of it,
Yeah. We don't like being told we can't do things.
No, not at all, dude. It's yeah,
It's
it
like you tell
usually
your
makes it
kid not to
worse.
smoke, you're just going to make him think about what's smoking like? Why is he telling me
Right.
that? What am I
Yeah.
missing? Well, we went on a lot of different topics today, Randall. It's great to
Yeah.
have you on, and I like the idea of having these conversations once in a while to kind of recap some of the recent interviews and just delve into whatever's on our mind. So I really appreciate you. And as a friend, as someone that's been helping me with this podcast, and I'm also really excited to see what you're doing with your channel. I think you're doing a great job. I encourage my listeners, especially if you're interested in like health and fitness stuff. Randall's been dishing this stuff out for a while, and I think you're really getting good at conveying message. You're a very clear speaker with your content, and it's organized very well. You're much more organized than me, and I think it's very effective, and it's exciting to see your channel grow. Always Adaptive is the name of the channel, so I do recommend you all check it out. Is there anything else you want to add today before we wrap it up?
No, that's it. I mean, thanks for having me on, man. And, you know, just going back to what we were talking about in the beginning, you know, I think you've done, I'm seeing the evolution that you're going on and, you know, trying to give a, I mean, I hesitate to use the word pushback, but that's what it is. And, you know, to the audience, if you are listening to Les and you do feel some sort of way when he does push back or ask some clarifying questions to a guest, just remember that this, the job of a podcast should not just be to platform people and just let them go on an hour long tangent. You know, Les is very knowledgeable in many different topics. And so it just makes sense. And for someone like me, that's evidence based. I like it when a podcast host doesn't just give people free rein to spew a bunch of nonsense. Not saying that they were spewing a bunch of nonsense, but that can certainly happen. If a podcast host is too passive, then the person can just go on a 10-minute tirade, and you, the listener, are not going to benefit from that. You're going to have all kinds of, you know, misinformation going in your head, and you're just going to think that that's the truth, you know? And so it's important, in my opinion, I think, just real quick example, Dr. Mike Varshavsky, the Checkup podcast, he has started doing in his podcast, whenever someone says, makes a claim about a study or anything like that, a bell will go off. And at the bottom, it'll link to a video that he makes separate to that, where he actually goes through, like if they cite a study, he'll go through the study and like fact check them in real time. And I think that's amazing. I think that's like, we need more of that. Not saying that you need to take your time to do that, but you're pushing back in the way that you know how to do, which I think is great. And I hope you keep doing it.
Yeah. Appreciate that, man. Thanks for the kind words. Well, for listeners, I hope you enjoyed this. I know we went over a lot of different stuff today and just kind of had fun. So I hope you got something out of it. And if you have something to comment about it, please share it. Be nice. And, you know, we'll do our best to chime in and answer any questions or comments you have. Thanks again for listening. Always grateful for your listening. I hope you all have a great day.
Bye.